Welcome to the Currency.News podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to be curious.
Welcome to the Currency Weekend podcast. I'm Dion Fanning. We're talking with Johnny O'Reilly today. Johnny has been reporting for The Currency and for many other publications and broadcasters, including Rolling Stone, RTE, The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. The last time we talked to Johnny, he was in Odessa. He's now back in Kyiv, where he lives. Johnny, I wonder, firstly, if you could tell us what it was like to return to Kyiv.
Well, I returned about 2 weeks ago. I took an overnight train. And, you know, arriving into the city, you never know quite what to expect. And I was quite pleasantly, I wouldn't even say surprised, I think I expected it anyway, that, you know, a certain normality had started to seep back in. Some shops, some supermarkets were open, and people were trying to just, you know, return to some semblance of normality. You know, I mean, I suppose you could categorize people into different groups. There's those who left, who became refugees and left. There are those who went to fight in the, you know, either in the main army or in their what's called the Terra Verona. And then there are those who stayed behind to volunteer for the war effort. Most people would be in that category. So they're maybe working part-time as a volunteer, helping with some humanitarian food distribution, or raising finance for someone else who is doing that, or delivering supplies. But most of that is quite part-time. So people still have, you know, a family to take care of, or elderly parents to take care of. So, you know, when you have that situation, you try to kind of get a routine going that's, you know, resembles some kind of a normality. So that was the difference, returning back to Kyiv after the first week where things were things were in a real state of havoc. And now I've been here for 2 weeks, and every day things get more and more normal. More supermarkets are open. Restaurants are now starting to reopen. The curfew, which was originally at 7 o'clock, then moved to eight o'clock in the evening, and now it's at 9 p.m. So people are adapting to the rhythm of war, really. We have a better understanding of the risk assessment. There hasn't been any let up in the amount or the ferocity of rockets or artillery hitting the outskirts of the city, but we've become a bit inured to them, and we know how now what the chances are that they're going to hit the city center. And we have a clear understanding of the battlefield dynamics. So once people understand that, then it's a bit easier for them to make the risk assessment about what they do in their everyday life.
That's interesting that you say that, you know, the war itself hasn't changed, because I was going to ask you, when you say there's this normality returning, is that something to do with the peace talks, with this idea that Russia has said that, you know, they are withdrawing from around cities, they're withdrawing their positions from around cities like Kyiv? Or is it just that sense that you can get used to anything?
Well, it's a mix of both. Yeah, you can get used to anything. But also, yes, I mean, look, the Russians claim that they're going to make a drastic reduction in the attacks on Kyiv and Chernihiv. The Pentagon came out with an update assessment that 20% of their forces have been removed from those two cities. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the other 80% are going to be idle. But also it means that the Ukrainians are going to push back on those positions that have perhaps been liberated. And whenever you're doing that, you need a lot of outgoing artillery cover. So a lot of the sounds that we've been hearing, mostly at night, may well be outgoing fire from the Ukrainians positioned perhaps, say, 15 or 20 kilometers from the city center. They're lobbing those over, you know, to a position that is 30 kilometers from the city center. But it's hard to know. We don't have, you know, up-to-date battlefield statistics of exact positions. But certainly there is a feeling that things in the short term are calming down around the outskirts of the city. But people don't believe the Russians. They don't take them at their word. Most analysts believe that this is an effort at regrouping, resupplying, and they could well come back in a different formation with different tactics. Presumably, they will have learned the lessons of their first offensive, and they could well come back. Nobody knows, but I'm sure the Ukrainian defense forces are building up their defenses regardless.
And Johnny, you returned, and obviously you're working there, but you also live in Kyiv. It's your home too. So I wonder, like, how you felt coming, like, when you were heading back on that train from Odessa. Like, were you concerned? Did you think this is your only choice, or did you think maybe I should, head west like lots of other people?
I actually didn't have any of those thoughts because, you know, one of the things about traveling in overnight trains in this part of the world is that you typically buy a ticket for a 4-bed cabin. And I was traveling on my own. And so I was with these three other people, a family, a very nice woman and her daughter, and a crazy, brutal Egyptian husband who kept on wanting to talk to me. And he was crazy. And so I was very distracted just by being in close confinement with those people. So I didn't get to think too much about what had happened. So sorry, I can't remember exactly specifically what you're asking, but that's
just how you felt coming back. Cause you are reporting on what's happening there, but you also is your home. So you're in a slightly different position than many of the other journalists there who have come to Ukraine to report. And, you know, lots of journalists have also been there and left for various reasons. So I just wonder if you had any doubts about heading back to, like, what are you, I imagine you did have some doubts, but how strong were those concerns about heading back there?
Well, I mean, I really wanted to get back to my home, to my apartment. And I really wanted to reconnect with and find out who out of my friends are still in the city. And I was delighted to uncover a few people and to, you know, to spend time with them and share information and stories with them. One of the things about wartime is, obviously it's a real kind of, crucible of intensity, and people react under stress in different ways. So you get to see how friends and acquaintances of yours act in that manner. And a lot of people surprise you. You know, some people are much stronger than you think. Other people's are the opposite. I've witnessed and been in a lot of arguments and fights with people more than normally, because obviously people are just under stress.
And what are the fights about?
Nothing, just in a slightly more intense environment, people lose their temper more easily. Simple as that. There's nothing specific really about it. People are under stress here. And actually, to be honest, most of what I'm describing are amongst journalists. So, the local population are fairly chilled and relaxed and can take things in their stride. It's the war correspondents who spend half their life in these kind of war zones, but I guess still suffer from stress and fatigue because they have a job to do as well. And it's a very competitive environment for them. They're very bitchy about other people. It's been quite a revelation for me because I'm not normally a war correspondent, but I've been hanging out with all of them recently and getting to scratch the surface of their world. There's a lot of, I suspect even without a war, there would be a lot of strife and conflict in their lives.
And the city itself then, like you've talked about that, like, you know, the different strands of you know, what's going on. Like there was an alcohol ban, I believe. Is it now lifted or it's been lifted tonight? As we speak on Friday? I believe
April Fool's Day, they've lifted it between, I think, like 2 p.m. and 6 p.m. or something like that. So people can have their drinks, they can buy alcohol in shops. So, I mean, that's probably a fairly significant development with regards to social policy. So today's the first day. So I haven't actually been outside yet. I don't know if people are falling around the streets drunk or not. I suspect people are still going to be quite disciplined about that. They're not Irish after all.
Mm. And is it, Johnny, like, again, like that, you, this week, and you're writing about this for the Currency this weekend as well, and you'll go into more detail, but can you talk a little bit about where you've been this week and what you've seen? Because if Kyiv has been normal, the outside Kyiv, we've become familiar with the names of places like Irpin and towns like that, which, you know, have been the scene of some of the most harrowing and brutal images of the war.
Yeah, so the article is partly about the contrasts of life in war, literally just about 10, 15 kilometers from where I'm sitting, the center of Kyiv. There's a river which separates the Kyiv administrative district from the Kyiv outskirts, and the first town on the outskirts in the northwest is Irpin, a very small, lovely town full of trees, the kind of place where young professional families and people who want to commute, people who want to commute to the city will settle if they can afford it. It's an upmarket place. And that was the nearest to Kyiv that the Russians reached. It was under occupation by them for about 2 or 3 weeks. And I went there and went to the outskirts of Irpin and met many people who were still trickling out from there, most of them elderly people. And they told me some shocking stories about summary executions in front of them, about wide-scale, indiscriminate targeting of civilian homes with howitzers and tanks. Much of the town has been reduced to rubble. There are hundreds, someone told me thousands, of pets who have been abandoned just wandering around the place. Dead bodies still in the street. They might have been removed by now, but a couple of days ago they were there. As the Russians retreated, they left booby traps in some of the doorways into the homes, and the fear was some of those dead bodies were mined, so that's why they were allowed to lay on the ground for so long. So just the images of death and destruction and even the way people relate them to you. It feels that almost there's a bit of cognitive dissonance between that and then just down the road, people chilling out in cafes, you know. And I got the feeling that the full horrors of this war have not really sunk in. They will over time.
You mean in Kyiv?
Not only, yeah, in Kyiv, but all across the country. So Irpin is a microcosm of what's happened in other cities like Mariupol, Chernihiv, where the Russians controlled a wider area. But pretty much everywhere where the Russians controlled, there was death, destruction, multiple accusations of rape have come out. People have been treated extremely badly, you know, the kind of atrocities you would associate with the worst of the wars that we're familiar with from the Middle East. So this is something that is ongoing in multiple places around the country. And because of the very fast dynamic of war and the intensity with which people are just pursuing their activities, I think the full horror of that has yet to sink in. In time it will, but right now people don't have time to sit and ponder on that because everyone's just engaged in such a battle for survival or fleeing or just getting their life together. But yeah, that struck me as quite a contrast given that the city center in Kyiv right now is quite relaxed and chill.
And people from Irpin presumably are arriving in Kyiv and like if they're not leaving the country, they're leaving that town.
A lot of people who live in Kyiv, that's their home. So they don't have a second home in Kyiv. Like a lot of people in Kyiv who live in apartments, they have a second home or their relative or grandparents or someone has a second home at the countryside. So Irpin kind of is the countryside. So a lot of those people have nowhere to go. So they're being shipped off to the west. I guess maybe some of them have friends that they can stay with in the city. But the few people that I spoke to on the edge of the town who were evacuated, this is the day before yesterday, they were all being shipped to other cities around the country. Now, they were all elderly people. Now, there are still a lot of people in Irpin, many people whose homes presumably are still standing or whose homes can be renovated, that they're staying behind to fix up their home. It's the people whose homes have been damaged beyond repair who are the ones who are leaving. Most of those who wanted to leave in their early days probably did, those with young children. But the elderly people left behind were the ones who suffered the worst horrors and witnessed all those atrocities.
And what do people in general in Ukraine feel? And obviously there isn't a uniformity about that, but how do they feel aside from the horrors of what's happening to them or to their families? How do they feel about the way the war is going? What is their feeling about, say, the peace talks, the ideas, the you know, what's being negotiated there? Is there a desire for a settlement, or is the spirit of defiance that was there, you know, over the first few weeks, is that still the overwhelming feeling of people, do you think?
Well, I mean, the peace talks are very much proceeding in parallel with the battles, with the battlefield advantages. And people don't believe in the peace talks. Most people don't believe in them, and even military and analysts recognize that the final peace deal will be informed by who has the best battlefield advantage. So most people are very focused on victory, and that, you know, they see this as a fairly simple but terrifying zero-sum game where everything is on the table. Victory at all costs. And I suspect that is that feeling weaves its way through the whole country, right down to the Azov fighters on the front line in Mariupol, who have still refused to surrender. They'll probably fight till the death. And that's the defiance that I've seen and witnessed amongst Ukrainian people across the whole country. So that's the focus, and that remains the focus. People believe it. Now, over time, you know, if this becomes a much longer drawn out war than people hope or expect, then those feelings can evolve. But I still sense that that's what people are focused on.
And what are your feelings on it, Johnny? Because we talked on Monday, we just chatted on Monday, and you were saying that you were more pessimistic maybe than some people about what was going to happen, not just with the peace talks, which I think, you know, lots of people will be rightly skeptical about anything that Russia says in those peace talks. But you had a more overarching kind of pessimism than that. I wonder would you say that's a right way of describing how you felt, and how has it evolved over the week?
Yeah, it has. I mean, that was Monday, you know. Yeah. So, like, literally, you every day the feelings changes slightly, and it kind of swings from one to the other. But I do feel that, broadly speaking, the Western media has perhaps a bit too much of an optimistic / positive tone on things, and one of the reasons is that if you, but like all the media, they all get all their information, their clips, their videos, their text from Telegram channels. So Telegram, like, you know, imagine a mix of WhatsApp and Facebook. So people are basically uploading video, text, and, you know, other content to these channels. And that's where, if you sign up to one of these channels, you get all the information you need almost in real time about what's happening across the whole battlefield. And when you look at the Russian Telegram channels, they are exactly like a mirror image of all the Ukrainian ones. So CNN, Channel 4, all of them, they're all getting the same information from, you know, half a dozen Ukrainian Telegram channels. But when you look at the Russian ones, they're kind of the exact same. You've got the same footage of, you know, Ukrainian POWs being, you know, questioned, of Ukrainian tanks and armored vehicles being blown up, of Ukrainian, you know, helicopters and jets being blown out of the sky. Now, obviously, you know, Russia being the mother load of propaganda, you know, one has to take everything you see in the Russian Telegram channels with a pinch of salt. But I think you have to recognize that the Ukrainian channels do not post information about Ukrainian losses. You know, they only post information about Russian losses. And it feels that the Western media have just fallen into the narrative that all they see are Russian losses. Now, I think that Russia, being a much bigger army, can suffer and absorb a much more losses than the Ukrainians can, and still remain in the fight. So I'm not quite as optimistic as many of the Western analysts believe. But that doesn't mean to say that I think the war is definitely going to be lost or won. I still think it's in the balance. But what's likely to happen now is the kind of climax of the whole war is going to move towards the east part of the country, the Donbass. So Russia has already indicated that it's moving a lot of its personnel and military armor to that region. And there's been a fairly significant uptick of artillery warfare in various towns around there. So that looks like it's, you know, setting up to be the big mother of all battles, if you like. And it's probably the kind of format that suits Putin better, because you've got like a vast steppe in that region. Wars will be taking place less in towns and more across large expanse of just agricultural land. And one can imagine that the superior firepower of the Russians will give it an advantage in that setting. But that's just one option. You know, it's so dynamic, and the wars happen in so many different directions. It's very hard with any accuracy to decide to kind of estimate what's going to happen next.
And like that's, the context of the war obviously then has a greater context as well, because when you talk about how the war is going, there's always that sense and that fear that if things go badly, and if what Putin will do, he is capable of anything. And, you know, we have another podcast this weekend with Nicholas Mulder, who's written about economic sanctions, and he's making that point in terms of the more the sanctions bite, the more capable again Putin is of doing anything. And we saw it, you know, in economic sense, when he talked, you know, he threatened to cut off, to blackmail Europe over energy supplies if they didn't pay in rubles on Thursday. But in the war itself, there are similar dangers and similar threats. So whatever way you look at it, there's always that danger that if things aren't going the way Putin wants them to go, his options, he could make things very bad indeed, either for the people, even worse for the people of Ukraine, or for people in surrounding countries or in Europe as a whole.
Yeah, but I don't think that's a strong argument for appeasement. You know,
I'm not making an argument for appeasement.
I know that you're not, but I mean, some people may be doing that because you think that, well, you know, you don't want to stoke Putin too much because he can always escalate. He's going to escalate even if you don't escalate yourself. He has shown time and again that he will always go on the offensive. He will always be the aggressor, both diplomatically, economically, and militarily. For the last 20 years, unfortunately, the pessimists have always been correct when it comes to predicting what Putin will do next. And the people who know him the best, people like, you know, the people in the Russian opposition movement, Andrei Ilya Narev, who worked with him for 5 years in the early days, obviously Navalny, all of these people believe that Putin has this kind of mafia / thuggish mentality. He only understands force, and he can only be aggressive until he stops, or until he is stopped. And I think the history has proved them right. And I believe Biden understands that. And I think certainly the Ukrainians understand it, that they're pushing for victory. They're not pushing for compromise. And I think if victory doesn't happen in Ukraine, there's a very high chance that technically he will commit genocide on the Ukrainian people and will threaten the borders of Poland and the Baltic states thereafter. So most European leaders should be by now, and I think Boris Johnson has, but they should be by now realizing that they have to take on Putin sooner or later and defeat him. And better do it now than later when he might be stronger.
Johnny, it's been fascinating talking to you as always. Thank you again for your time, and thanks for your journalism this weekend in The Currency.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to the Currency.news podcast, powered by Investec. It pays to to be curious.